Hey folks, Scott Weingart here, and this is the MCrypt Podcast. Alright, first off, if you have any feedback about the theme music, please shoot me an email. I'm very curious. I've gotten mixed response. Some folks like it. Those folks seem to come from the South or the West. I have heard comments along the Deliverance lines. Thank you, Ram from Canada. So let's hear what you think. But to the show at hand. Today, we're going to talk about perhaps the most important topic of any we've covered thus far, and that is palliative and end-of-life care in the emergency department. What I tell all my critical care specialists, or pretty much any resident I train, is that if you're going to do ED critical care, which is some of the most aggressive medicine around, it is only acceptable if you balance it with equally aggressive palliative care. They're kind of like two ends of a continuum, and you need to be exceedingly good at both. If you don't have a good basis in palliative care, and I teach you all these aggressive curative therapies, it's kind of like giving a gun to a maniac or control of a major nation's military forces to an inept idiot. It's not a good idea. So all too commonly, we have a patient coming in from the nursing home and they're in some respiratory distress, and the easiest course, the course of least resistance, is just to intubate that patient and ship them upstairs. But that really is not the best thing for the patient. It's not the best thing for our hospital, our healthcare system, and for us as physicians. It's not the right thing to do. There is a better way. It takes a little more time and a little more dedication, but I think it's worth it. So here's the MCrit approach to end of life and palliative care in the ED. It starts with step one, which is identifying the potential comfort care patient. Because if you don't think to ask, then you're just going to go with full court press curative therapies. And it very well might be that no one's going to ask until the patient's languished in the hospital for days and days, receiving dialysis and intubation and pressors, and they might not have ever wanted that in the first place. So step one is identifying the potential comfort care patient. And so who, you know, sets off my potential comfort care radar? Well, if you're coming from a nursing home, that's a big clue. And I'm not talking a rehab facility where you broke your hip and you're getting some physical therapy for a couple weeks. But if you're a long-term nursing home player, perhaps that's someone to address these issues. It doesn't necessarily mean they're purely comfort care. It just means you're going to look into the issue. Age. If they're really old, you look into the issue. I'm not addressing comfort care questions on a 40-year-old unless they have some terminal disease. 85-year-old, I'm going to start asking the questions. Now, maybe I'll get answers to know that this person was playing tennis and managing their stock portfolio yesterday. Fine. We're not going to go down a comfort care route unless the family wants that. But we're going to ask the questions. What's their state of decline? Do they have decubiti? Do they have skin decomposition? This is all signs that a patient isn't living a particularly active lifestyle. And then, of course, the more objective criteria, how many tubes and catheters do they have protruding from their body when they arrive in the ED? Generally, the presence of a feeding tube is a good indication to ask these questions.
Do they have dementia? Very, very important. If the nursing home sheet says severe dementia, that's a key.
All right. Once you identify a potential comfort care patient, the idea now is to temporize, to give you time to ask the valuable questions. So that means if they come in with respiratory distress, you don't rush to intubate them. Put them on non-invasive ventilation. You could temporize almost any patient, curative or comfort care, with non-invasive for a little while at least. And don't give me the prohibition against altered mental status. We're not talking long-term here. We're talking for 10, 20 minutes so that you could ask the right questions. They'll be fine on non-invasive for that period of time. Don't intubate them. put them on the non-invasive, and ask the right questions. If they have hypotension, well, give them some fluids through a peripheral IV, and if you need to, give them some phenylephrine through a peripheral IV until you ask the questions. You don't need to put a central line in. All right, so now you got them temporized, you got some time. Now, it might very well be the patient can communicate, in which case you could establish goals of care with them. Most of the cases in the patients we're dealing with in ED, it's going to be a family member. So how do you establish goals of care? Well, let me explain what goals of care are. In my mind, in the ED, there's basically two. There's aggressive curative therapies, which means we're going to try to get the patient better with all the means we have at our disposal. And then there's aggressive comfort care. And that means our main goal is to make sure the patient experiences no pain or discomfort. Now, we might still be giving some therapy. We might be giving them some antibiotics, some fluids. But our main goal is to make sure they're not in distress. Now, those goals sometimes are at odds, which is why you have to establish these goals of care. It's not to say that if we go down a curative pathway, we can't keep the patient well controlled in terms of pain and discomfort. And it's not saying we're not going to give any therapies to the comfort care patient. It's saying, what is our main goal? So how do you establish that? Well, first thing is to ask for any advanced directives. And there's a whole bunch out there. You got to become familiar with them in your own state and your own hospital, because everyone varies a little. I know New York best of all. So that's where I'm going to talk about a majority of the stuff. You have to find out how this pertains to your state. What I will say is, in the state of New York in the United States, we are the worst palliative care state in the country, excepting maybe Missouri. And that is hopefully going to change in New York. There's a passage of a new bill that actually allows family members to make decisions for their loved ones. Up until that point, it didn't really matter what the family members wanted. It only mattered if they witnessed a conversation with their loved one. That's hopefully changing. But as it stands right now at this moment, we kind of stink in terms of palliative care. They make everything really difficult to do what you know in your heart and the family knows is the right thing. So what advanced directives are you going to see? There's going to be a DNR, a do not resuscitate order. If they have that, it only really pertains to arrest situations. But what most people don't understand, at least in New York, is that the DNR pertains both to cardiac arrest, your heart stops, or to respiratory arrest. If you stop breathing in New York with a DNR, you cannot be intubated. You should not be intubated. Do not intubate these patients. DNR means respiratory arrest. It doesn't refer to respiratory distress in terms of intubation. So if they're having trouble breathing and they don't have any advanced directives, you might, if you interpret the law that way, feel obligated to intubate them. If they stop breathing, a DNR is very clear. No intubation. A DNI means do not intubate in the setting of respiratory distress. A healthcare proxy gives a family member or a friend or someone that the person chooses to make healthcare decisions for them. And you could essentially just treat them as if they were the patient, as long as the patient is not conscious enough to answer your questions.
Now, in New York, any family member or even a close friend at times can sign a DNR order, but you need to be a healthcare proxy to sign a DNI order, at least in the ED, which is problematic, and hopefully that new law will change all that.
Living will really has no legal standing in the hospital. It's a way for the patient to express their wishes. But what I will say is the living will gives you the ability as a healthcare practitioner to make decisions for that patient if it's going along with their wishes as expressed in that living will. There's a new device called a MULST. I'm not going to spend too much time about it because it's not out there very often, but a MULST actually allows the patient to establish DNR and DNI and a few other things in a legally binding manner. They're printed on pink forms in New York. They're very, very good stuff. They're not out there yet, at least in the places I'm working. All right, let's say your patient has a DNR, they have a DNI. That's a pretty good indication to me what their goals of care are. And that means, for me, for the most part, comfort care. And yes, you could argue, DNR doesn't mean that. DNR just applies to arrest, and really these patients haven't expressed anything. Yeah, I'll tell you. If you show me a patient with a DNR and DNI, and I can't talk to them, and the family members haven't heard otherwise, that, for me, If in my judgment, the patient does not have a particularly good prognosis or an excellent quality of life preceding this illness, that's generally an indication to me of comfort care. And yes, you could write me tons of letters, and of course there's exceptions to that situation, but that is my practice. And of course, individual circumstances will dictate differently, but that's kind of a hint as to which way to go.
Now, this brings us to something of an ethical dilemma in the minds of some doctors, and it doesn't make sense to me, but I think I need to address it. There's this belief in the minds of many emergency physicians that we're not entitled to make decisions for the patient in terms of end-of-life decisions, that it's not our role. Well, I'll tell you, those decisions are being made by your colleagues every single shift. When the ICU looks at a patient's quality of life and prognosis and says they're not an ICU candidate, they're basically dictating that that patient is not going to do very well down a curative road. And no one seems to have a problem with that. I've never had a hospital object to an ICU rejecting a patient due to the fact that they're 95 years old, demented, and have no quality of life. So it's okay for them. The renal guys routinely don't do dialysis on patients based on their prognosis and quality of life. The surgeons won't take patients to the operating room based on their prognosis and quality of life. You are just as capable of doing that. It's not paternalistic. It's just good medicine. It doesn't make you the member of a death panel. It makes you a good emergency physician. So it's pretty easy when the patient has a DNR and a DNI.
All right, but those situations are generally easier. What about the situation where the patient hasn't done any advance directives, which is all too common, at least in the places I work at? We have terminal cancer patients. The patients have been told by their oncologist this is a non-survival disease, and no one has discussed advance directives. No one has broached the subject. We have patients long-term in the nursing home. No one has brought up advance directives, ever. Why am I the guy doing this? It's a constant source of frustration. That being said, you have to be the guy sometimes. So how do you do it? Well, all too commonly, I'll ask residents to go have a discussion about end-of-life issues, and they'll say something like, do you want your mom to be DNR? And, you know, sometimes they're not that bad. They'll explain what DNR means, and they'll just say, you know, if their heart was to stop, do you want us to do CPR? And this is not the way to conduct these conversations. Inevitably, you're going to get an answer that's not in correlation with the patient's wishes. You got to be a little more diligent with this stuff in terms of doing it right. So here's how I play it, and this is just my opinion. You could take it as you will. First of all, you establish who the family member is. You introduce yourself. You establish rapport. You sit down. These are not great conversations to be having standing up. We have in our resus area, we have a nursing station. It's in the center of the room. They can see their loved one. They don't have to be scared. They're going to miss something about their care. And we just sit them down in a chair. I sit down next to them, and we have a discussion. Here's how it goes for me. So the first question I ask is, did you ever have a conversation about what your loved one would have wanted in terms of medical care at the end of their life? And sometimes they'll say, oh yeah, she said she would never want to be on a machine. She would not want a tube down her throat. And boom, you're there. That's the most important thing they could tell you, is what their loved one has actually expressed. And if you get that, then you're great. And everyone's in agreement at that point. Well, we're not going to do that kind of stuff because your loved one wouldn't have wanted. And I don't even ask any questions beyond that, because there is nothing more important than the wish of the actual patient. All right, let's say you talk to them about that and they say, no, we never really spoke about it. Here's my thought. You're the physician. Your job is to handle the interpretation of the medical care. Your job is to do whatever limited amount you can on prognostication, and we are really bad at prognostication. And here's the most important thing. Your job is to figure out medically what their quality of life was before this illness. All right? The family member's job is to the best of their abilities, express what their loved one's wishes would have been. So here's how it goes for me. Pretend I'm talking to the daughter. Patient is her mom. Really sick, comes in from the nursing home, baseline dementia, never really had mental status for the past couple of years, and she has a bad pneumonia now. So generally, this is how the conversation would go for me. So I know this is tough to talk about, but your mom, she's quite ill, and we need to make some decisions. If she got sick enough to have her heart stop, or if she was to stop breathing, we do have machines that could start her heart. We have machines that could breathe for her. But if she got to that point, if she was that sick, I don't think she would ever really recover or come back to being the person you knew and cared for. Medically, if she got to that point, I don't think we should really try to do all those invasive things. I think if she got to the point where her heart was to stop or she was to stop breathing, we should just let her pass away peacefully. If it was my mom, that's what I would be doing. That's the decision I would make based on my medical judgment and knowing what my mom would want. And I just wanted to get your opinion of that plan. And then you see what their reaction is. Now, there's a few things that are important to understand about doing it that way. First of all, you're not asking them if they want to limit care in their loved one. And that is intentional. And that's not due to paternalism. It's not because I think I know better than them. It's a very subtle thing. But if you ask them, do you want me not to intubate your mom? Do you want me not to intubate your mom? Then when their mom passes away from not getting intubated, that guilt is on them. They caused their mom's death. Even if it was the right thing to do, you've given them a big burden of guilt because they led to their mom's death. Now, they could rationalize it appropriately that it was the right thing to do, but you still gave them a whole bunch of crap they didn't need. You're the doctor. You have the broad shoulders. You take that responsibility. I don't think we should intubate. Do you have any objection to that plan? Now it's you. That's how it should be. That's what you're getting the money for, is to make the tough decisions. Now, of course, if they object, if they have a negative reaction to that, no problem. We're not going ahead with that, at least in America. Other countries, they are empowered to actually make those decisions based on pure medical factors. Here in the States, I don't think we're at that point. I don't necessarily think we should be. I tell them what the plan is. If they react negatively, we alter the plan. It's not paternalistic. It's, I think, just the right thing to do. All right. Another key, don't say the difference is whether we go down an aggressive pathway or a comfort pathway. We're aggressive either way. It's aggressive curative versus aggressive comfort. In both cases, we're working our butts off, and that's legitimate. You got to work hard to do good palliative care. The difference is just the aim of that care. Another key, don't start going down the road of listing off the individual therapies. Would we want dialysis? Would you want intubation? Would you want vasopressors? They're not physicians. These are just words. No matter how you think you're describing them, they're not really getting the discomfort that comes with those things. Don't do it. It's pretty pure here. I don't deal with, yes, I want dialysis, but no, I don't want vasopressors. It doesn't work for my paradigm of practicing emergency medicine or critical care. I don't even offer that as a possibility. It's either we go down a curative pathway or we go down a comfort pathway. And that's pretty much it.
And I'll just add in one more option. There are times where I don't know if they're going to do well or not, and or sometimes the family hasn't quite made a decision, and then you could offer a trial of critical care. And I would lay the groundwork for this now. What we could do is we could try critical care for a period of 12 hours. And if they get better, we could readdress it. If they're not getting better, then I really think we should switch to comfort care. And sometimes when you have a family member that just can't quite pull the trigger on doing what you probably think is the right thing to do, which is comfort care, that often will give them the time to deal with the issues and really make them feel they gave their loved one the best possible try to get better. So that's always an option as well. So the offer of a trial of critical care.
And oh my gosh, when I start having people come in and some doctor out there decided it was okay to convince a family that yes, we'll do CPR, but we won't intubate the patients who are DNI, but not DNR. Who thought this was a good idea? No. You see, you don't even get to DNI until you have a DNR, all right? Because we can't do CPR and bring someone back and not be able to intubate them. If you have a DNI, it's because you're already DNR. All right, let's say the family agrees with me. Let's say there's no doubt. There's not a family member calling in from California who disagrees. You don't even get into this stuff. If there's not agreement across the board, then just go down a somewhat curative pathway and let it get sorted out with the ethics committee or whoever needs to get involved. But most of the time, if you presented it properly, if you presented it in a compassionate manner, there is an objection, at least in New York. I hear Pennsylvania is different, but in New York at least, most family members want the right care for their family. They want to not subject their family members to unnecessary, non-helpful treatments if it means more discomfort. All right, so if the reaction is good, if everyone's in agreement, I reiterate just to make sure there's no doubt. And I say, so our goals are going to be to maximize comfort. It doesn't mean we won't give any treatment. We're going to still give antibiotics. If they had an pneumonia, we're still going to give fluids to keep them hydrated. But we're not going to escalate care. That's a key word to say. That means we're not going to go any further than we are right now. And we're going to maximize comfort. All right. And if there's still good reaction, then that's my plan. And at that point, I sign DNR. At least in New York right now, I can't sign DNI unless they have a healthcare proxy. Kind of ridiculous, but it's okay. It doesn't really affect my care. And I put a note in the chart saying, after extensive discussion with family, we've deemed our goals of care to be comfort, and we will now maximize pain control and avoidance of any procedures or therapies that will cause distress to the patient. And I put that as a progress note. All right, so step one was identifying potential. Step two was figuring out goals of care with either the patient or their family member. Step three is what I just said, which is signing the forms, DNR, DNI if possible, and that progress note about comfort care. What do you do if there's no family available and there doesn't seem to be any family that you can get in touch with? I have at times. What I like to do in those circumstances is I get one of my colleagues from the ICU service, ED intensive care. I get the intensive care docs who ordinarily would be admitting these patients if we went down a curative route. And the two of us just look over the patient, look over their medical status, and sometimes we'll actually address goals of care based just on two physician opinion. I don't expect most of you to be going about that. It's kind of tough in the ED unless you have a lot of experience with this, but that is possible as well. At least in New York, the law is very well suited to supporting you to do, or rather to not do, therapies that are not helpful to the patient. So that's always a potential. But let's leave that aside. We're not going to dwell on that. All right. For the most part, we're dealing now with patients that aren't going to expire in the ED. You're just addressing the goals of care for the rest of the hospitalization. Sometimes you'll have patients that are clearly pretty close to death already when they hit the ED. Maybe they're in severe respiratory distress, maybe they're in profound shock. And this is where we get to the end-of-life aspect. Pretty much what we've been talking about up until this point is a blend of palliative and end-of-life care. Let's talk about end-of-life care in the ED. So you have a critically ill patient, but you've deemed your goals of care to be comfort. Well, what do you do for that patient? First thing you do is you maximize pain control. The patient certainly should be in no pain at all if you're going down a comfort care path. For me, that means a fentanyl drip. On pretty much all of my PAL care patients, that's what I use, fentanyl drip. You could use a morphine drip as well. Fentanyl just works a little quicker. Start off with a 1 microgram per kilogram bolus of the fentanyl, and then I start them at the drip at the same rate. And that drip is going to keep getting titrated up with a small bolus each time I titrate up, until they are showing no signs of pain. No signs of pain. And there is no BP too low in these patients to start that fentanyl. This is a comfort care patient. Now you gotta understand the concept of double effect. Double effect in the palliative care world is the idea that even if the medications you administer will somewhat hasten the patient's demise, as long as the reasons you were giving it were to relieve pain and suffering, then that is absolutely an appropriate therapy. So for instance, if the patient's showing me signs of pain and their blood pressure is 50 over 20, and that additional fentanyl will lower their blood pressure further, but they are showing signs of pain, then it is very appropriate to give it. As long as your intent is to minimize suffering, then that is appropriate to keep going up on that medication. No sedation, at least in my opinion. There's no Ativan, Versed, propofol, what have you, because what those do is mask pain. They will prevent me from giving adequate analgesic doses. When you get the optimal dose of fentanyl, the patient will be very well sedated from it. Now, sometimes the patients have a lot of secretions that upsets the family members. It doesn't really upset the patients that much, but you want the family to be happy as well. I will give these patients glycopyrrolate, 0.2 milligrams. It dries up their secretions. It makes it a nicer end-of-life experience for the family members. All right, you need IV access in these patients because you can't titrate the pain medications very well giving them sub-Q. So I always will have an IV, even if that means starting an IV that wasn't there. What I will tell you is if you can't get an IV, don't do a central line. Here's what I now recommend. Pretty much every ED should have some form of IO, some form of intraosseous access for adults. We have the Easy IO. I represent no brands, as you know from my disclaimers. I am not being paid by anyone. I would say giving a little Lido and putting a tibial intraosseous is the most palliative care friendly way of getting IV access if you can't get it in the patient's arms after even like one or two sticks, because the pain from this is literally less than a second. If you give some Lido, it's even less, probably less pain than an IV in some cases. And boom, you have access that you can rely on throughout the patient's end of life period. So that's my take. I push some lidocaine through it once it's in to anesthetize the bone. And once you get an adequate dose of fentanyl, that IO won't bother them anymore. All right, let's say you have a patient who's intubated. They maybe got intubated by the paramedics and then you decide you're going down an end-of-life pathway. All right, you got a decision to make. You can do very good palliative care with the patient intubated. And in fact, then there's no secretion issues. The patient is on the ventilator. What I do is I turn the vent to 30% FiO2. I put them on the mode of CPAP, and I just put them on zero PEEP and zero pressure support. And that's how I could just do PAL care with the tube in. In New York, that's often the way I go because you can't extubate a patient without affidavits from the family stating they heard their family members say they wouldn't want a tube. Sometimes it takes a little while. I will just do good palliative care with that tube in. I'll give them aggressive fentanyl to the point where there's no discomfort from that tube. As long as the family members aren't upset by it, it's really not a problem. And it won't really
affect
respiratory demise because you're not really giving them any support by that tube. Let's say the family members don't like it. Let's say they had a DNI or they had a healthcare proxy. You could sign a DNI. And now in New York, you could extubate that patient. What you want to do is you want to send the family out. Extubation is kind of gross because there's all sorts of mucus clinging to that tube. You send them out, you tell them it'll just be 2 seconds. You put a chuck underneath it so you don't get the patient dirty because you want the patient to look nice, let their family members remember them in a good state. So you put a chuck under the tube, you suction out the tube, you suction out their mouth with a yank hour, you deflate the cuff, you have that yank hour handy and you pull it out, you suction anything that's dragging along the tube edge, and you suction out their mouth one more time. Make sure they're nice and presentable. You get rid of the chuck and the tube and you bring the patient's family members back in. That's it. Now, it surprisingly will take a really long time for some of these patients to pass away. And sometimes you actually will wind up admitting them to a bed, even though you're clearly going down an end of life passage. What I like to do is while they're in the ED, I just leave a pulse ox on them. No EKG leads, no blood pressure cuff. I turn off all the alarms on the monitor. Pulse ox is nice. It's unobtrusive. It doesn't generally bother the family members. It's not on their chest. It's not blocking their face. And it gives you a pulse rate. And it gives you the pulse ox waveform. When that disappears, that's when you tell the family members that you want to check the patient. And that's when you do your death check. You check your pulse and you make sure that they have actually expired. So I think I'm going to leave it there. Like I said, this is one of the most important issues we could address in ED critical care. Please send me your thoughts and comments. And if you have a second and you like the podcast, please, please go to iTunes. Give us a 5-star review. Write a couple lines there. If you have anything to say, I'd really appreciate it. All right, that's all for today. Have a great weekend. Bye-bye.